Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Du Hirsu.
With a musical introduction by Brendan Lowe, our director of music. Thanks for listening. Reading this morning comes from the Gospel of John, and I'll be reading from chapter 6, starting at verse 56, with Jesus speaking to those gathered around him. Those who eat my flesh and drink my blood abide in me, and I in them. Just as the living Father sent me, and I live because of the Father, so whoever eats me will live because of me. This is the bread that came down from heaven. Not like that which our ancestors ate and they died, but the one who eats this bread will live forever. He said these things while he was teaching in the synagogue at Capernaum. When many of his disciples heard it, they said, "This teaching is difficult, and who can accept this?" But Jesus, being aware that his disciples were complaining about it, said to them, "Does this offend you? Then what if you were to see the Son of Man ascending to where he was before? It is the Spirit that gives life. The flesh is useless. The words that I have spoken to you are spirit and life. But among you are some who do not believe." For Jesus knew from the first who were the ones that did not believe and who was the one that would betray him. And he said, "For this reason I have told you that no one can come to me unless it is granted by the Father." Because of this, many of his disciples turned back and no longer went about with him. So Jesus asked the 12, "Do you also wish to go away?" And Simon Peter answered him, "Lord, to whom can we go? You have the words of eternal life. We have come to believe and know that you are the Holy One of God."
My brother, when I look into the face of my enemy, I see my sister, Forgiveness is the garment of our courage, the power to make the peace we long to know. Open up our eyes to see the wounds that bind all of humankind. May our shattered hearts greet the dawn of life, the charity and love. When I look into the face of my enemy, I see my brother, I look into the face of my enemy. I see my brother.
I just want to open by saying something that people may already know, but I just want to say it. There is food. And there is food. Okay? Before we lived here in the Sacramento Valley, my husband Mark and I, lived in the Napa Valley. Before we lived in the Napa Valley for 9 years, we lived in Berkeley, where we were raised. In both cities, we had epic meals. Just epic meals. In Berkeley, honestly, the epic meals were mostly at Mark's mother's dining table. She cooks with love. It's beautiful. In the Napa Valley, There were many meals, but there were two epic meals that we had at a restaurant you may have heard of called the French Laundry. And we went to the French Laundry twice when you only had to save for 6 months to go there, not 6 years like it is now. Seriously. It was amazing. Berkeley and Napa, I call them food meccas. Do you know that somebody told me this, and it's true, I live there, so. There's a neighborhood in Berkeley, it's called Gourmet Ghetto. Did you know that? Seriously, that's what it's called. And it's known that way because it's such wonderful food there, but not just food. There's a man named Alfred Peet, and he opened a little place back in 1966. It was a hole in the wall where he roasted his own coffee beans, and he brewed his own coffee, and that little place was called Peet's. Maybe you've heard of it. Started in 1966. Alice Waters began on Shattuck Avenue down the street from Peet. Alice had been cooking in Europe, and she returned to Berkeley in the late 60s, and she couldn't find the ingredients that she needed to cook the way she cooked in Europe. Mainly three things: seasonal vegetables, seasonal fruits, and chocolate without sugar already added. Those were her main things that she was looking for. So she started on her own to source her food from around the Bay Area. She talked to some people, and that was the beginning of her restaurant, Chez Panisse, which opened in 1971. My family moved to Berkeley in 1972. We are blessed. Chez Panisse was a neighborhood bistro, and in both locations, Chez Panisse and Peet's, the message was very subtle, but it was serious. It was this: sit down, sip, eat, enjoy. Talk with your friends and family. Meet your neighbors. Commune with the food and the drink and each other. Talk to the chefs about your experience. And no one knew it would be the start of California cuisine at that time. No one knew that pour over drip espresso coffee was going to happen and be hip. No one knew then about something we now call the slow food movement. I received an email from one of our folks back in January. It was right after Winter Sanctuary, and she wrote to one of the chefs in our community with the hope of connecting the teen moms that she worked with so that they could learn about food. And this is what she said in the email: "You could sponsor a birthday cake for a girl, or a fresh fruit day where they would get to try new fruits for the very first time." This is in Sacramento. She said, "I had a 17-year-old member the other day that had never eaten a raspberry because they're too expensive at the grocery store. Or you could use it for a holiday supplemental food for girls that don't have food options of their own at home. 17 years old, never tasted a raspberry in California because raspberries cost too much at the grocery store. They're $4 a basket in season." There's a man named Norman Wiersbaugh who is professor of theology, ecology, and agrarian studies at Duke Divinity School. And he's written at length about this in his book, Food and Faith. It's up here if anyone wants to see it. Here's some of what he says: "Eating, along with the work and sharing that all eating presupposes, is the most fundamental means we know for understanding and appreciating the range and depth of creation's memberships. When we're involved in food production and when we eat with intelligence and sympathy," he says, "we learn about our place in the world, and we discover that creation is an indescribably complex, vast, and deep food web, and that others intersect with us at multiple points as sources of inspiration and nurture. And then we begin to see and taste how some patterns of life are inappropriate because they compromise, exhaust, or destroy that very food web. And we determine that some skills and practices further life, and those are to be commended. Things are really out of balance, people, when a young person of 17 years gets to that stage in her life and has never tasted a raspberry because it costs too much or she can't find one. Let's listen to a short interview here with that same man, Norman Wiersbaugh. And in this short clip, there's many of him, but I chose just this one for us to see him and listen to him. And he's going to talk to you about an image of God as the first gardener. God as a gardener, and his hope that people like us, congregations and churches, that we get the fundamentals from the biblical tradition of what it means to eat and to taste and to live in communion.
One of the exciting things, I think, is that churches all over the place now are starting up gardens, right? A lot of these churches are sitting on land, and right now it's in grass, or it's in ornamental trees and bushes. And the thing is, it doesn't need to be sitting there using, you know, a lot of chemicals and fertilizers to grow. Why can't some of this land be converted to production of flowers and fruit, vegetables, right? These trees could be used to grow apples. Right? And this then becomes a tremendous witness, I think, to the community when people in neighborhoods see that churches care about growing good food, helping people who maybe don't have access to good food get it. And in the meantime, I think church people can have this experience again of what it means to grow food, because trying to grow food is a true education. Right? You learn so much about yourself. You learn about how little you actually know, how little you actually control. So you learn some humility, you learn about gratitude, right? These are all really, really important things for church folks to understand. And, you know, God in the Bible is described as the first gardener, right? And that God's relationship to the world is the relationship of a gardener. Yeah, right, the beginning, Genesis 2. You got to read it. I mean, it's what's going on in that story is amazing, right? And this is before the fall, right? And so we think that when, you know, this first human being is asked to take care of the garden, we think that's a punishment. But that's reading Genesis 3. Genesis 2, people are invited to go work in the garden because that's what God's doing all the time. Which means then that when we garden and we do it with God, we learn something about who God is. We learn something about how God's gardening ways with the world are also God's caring ways with the world. So much so that if God were ever to stop gardening, right, and that means, you know, weeding, watering, nurturing, taking care of, protecting, all that stuff, if God ever stopped, we'd be done, right? And so we today tend to think that gardening is beneath us, right? We let poor people take care of the ground. And that's a real slap in the face to God, I think, because God made the care of the earth God's first priority. I think that's really profound.
That's hippie talk.
It is hippie talk.
I gotta read my Bible again.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. I don't have to say any of this because the Bible already says it. The Bible's a really radical book. And the Bible is always getting people back to really fundamental things. And fundamental things start with the ground. They start with the water. They start with the food you eat. Right? They start with sitting around a table, sharing things together. That's where it's going on. And, you know, we can talk about all kinds of programs and all that, and some of those are really fine. But we've got to stay to basics, because when we forget the basics like we have in our culture, we end up destroying the very things we need to live. And not just us, but that everybody needs to live. Right? What are we going to do when we don't have soil anymore? Or when there's no more fresh water? Then what? Are we going to eat money?
Can we be human without soil?
No, cannot. And in fact, the Bible makes that pretty clear on lots of levels. The first name for human being is Adam, and it comes from the Hebrew word for soil, Adamah. Right? We're earthlings from the beginning, and as soon as we forget that, we're in big trouble. If there's no soil, we stop living. It's just that simple. When the plants are gone, we stop breathing. Right? When the glaciers are gone, we stop drinking. It's just that simple. And so to think that that's being made up, that's just crazy. Right? What's new in our situation is that most of us now live in very insulated urban contexts where we have no idea about where food comes from, where water comes from, where energy comes from. We just think it's all there at the flip of a switch or the swipe of a credit card. And that's the most naive, ignorant relationship to the world that's possible. Right? So we're not making anything up when we talk about how land and food are central to the concerns of God. They have to be, because that's where our life happens. Right? All this stuff that we're focused on right now with our, you know, cell phones, which I have, and you know, our virtual world, that's optional. Right? We can live without that, but we cannot live without water. We cannot live without food. And so I'm trying to get people back to fundamentals, things that most people understood for centuries, because they lived on the land, they farmed the land, they gardened the land. And we are the new people in the world's history because we've lost that connection to the land.
What gives you hope?
Ecclesiastes says that there is hope for those who are joined to the living. Well, growing food joins you to the living, also to the dying, but to the living, and that's important.
The Bible is a fundamental document which helps us to understand that food joins us both to the living and to the dying. Food is about the relationships that join us to the earth, fellow creatures, loved ones, guests, and ultimately to God, which is why we're talking about all of this morning. How we eat is our witness to whether we value the creatures we live with and depend upon. And when our eating is mindful, we celebrate the goodness of fields and gardens and forests and watersheds and the skill of those who can nurture the seed and animal life into delicious food for all of us. And we acknowledge also and honor God as the giver of every good and perfect gift. And when our eating is mindful, we also learned, I hope, to begin to correct our own human arrogance and our boredom and also our ingratitude for all that we have so easily access to. You see, eating invites us to develop a deeper appreciation for where we are and who we are with, so that our eating is sacramental instead of sacrilegious. You see, having a thoughtful relationship to food, which holds all of these things together, it's a challenge. But it makes it possible for us to discover that eating is among the most intimate and pleasing ways possible for us to discover God. And so many people ask Matt and I all the time, how do I know God better? And when you say a simple thing like, slow down and eat mindfully, people are like, can't you just give me a Bible passage? See, that's why we're doing this series, Earth Honoring Faith. Last week, Matt gave us a sweeping view of what we need to care about. And it's a lot in order to practice a faith that honors our earth. Next week, we're going to look at how we might consume with a sense of responsibility. The final week, Matt's going to address climate issues. And this morning, you can tell, I'm talking about food and eating and how we commune with each other. You see, we break bread with our companions, at the table each Sunday as a reminder of the ways in which God daily blesses and feeds us every day. We root our lives in grace by understanding this, by understanding how through Christian community, God shapes us into one people. We're companions in Christ through communion. And through communion, which is also there, it's also called sometimes Eucharist. So I want to do just a short word thing. Companion, that word, comes to us from the Latin, and it's two words. Com, which means with, and panis, which means bread. With bread is what companioning means. Communion is literally two words, common union, right? And Larry Rasmussen writes about Eucharist, the moral ethos of leaning into the world in this way of communion, that's what he's talking about, is signaled in the word Eucharist. We use the word companions and communion, but he's talking about Eucharist, and that's a word for Thanksgiving. Companion, bread with Thanksgiving. If the bread of heaven is shared freely and equally with all as God's own way in the world, and if all are welcome, as we say, to this table, then why do we not always welcome everyone at every table in this way that becomes sacramental? It's a challenge, that's why. You see, we talked a few weeks ago about what kind of man Jesus is, and we hear him described this morning in the scripture that Matt read as the bread that came down from heaven. And I know there is a lot in that passage which on the surface can sound exclusive and frankly just sound gross. Those who eat my flesh and drink my blood abide in me and I in them. We don't talk that way a lot unless you're watching that show on HBO. True Blood. So let's back away from that, and maybe it's helpful to remember that when we read these words from the Gospel of John, we're reading theology, not a scientific explanation, but people trying to understand how to take God into their life. And fleshiness is important to Christian theology, and incarnation is central to how we think about and encounter and try to understand God, which is very difficult. The incarnation is about living in flesh. Flesh. And Jesus says that those who eat his incarnate holiness actually take him inside of ourselves. And he lived in the flesh when he spoke those words, the historic Jesus. But now he lives in the flesh in the bodies of all of us who follow him. Imbibing the embodied Christ, taking him into our experience of how we live, that's how we step in to following Jesus and trying to follow God the way Jesus did. And what did Jesus do? One of the number one things? He ate with people. He had meals with people. He used those meals as time to teach and learn about God, about reordering power structures, simply by who he sat down with. It's as simple as that. And that's what he calls us to do as well when we gather around tables for meals. In the way that we gather at this table, it's how we little by little become to believe and to know who and what God is in our lives. Mindful practices of eating, like what we establish at communion, can help us to be healthier and holier people. There's another part in the Bible in 1 Corinthians where it says, so whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do everything for the glory of God. Paying attention to food, its source and its quality, its preparation and its enjoyment is reflected in those words. Those who eat my flesh and drink my blood abide in me and I in them. Maybe we can hear it differently in this way. According to the slow food trinity, food has to be three things: good, clean, and fair. Back in 2008, there was an article in The Nation by Eric Schlosser, and he explained these terms. Good means it tastes good. Clean food means it's local and it's organic, and it has been produced in a sustainable way. And fair means there is a system that has done all this, that is committed to social justice for those who produce the food especially, and for those who want to eat it. Good, clean, and fair food is food produced in ways that confess how dependent we are on the earth and how essential are our relationships with each other. And committing to these kind of good, clean, and fair principles presents us with regular reminders to give thanks and recognition to the source of our food and the people who produced it. And one of the best ways to see how your faith joins you to the world, it's really simple, is to just think about what you eat. Norman Wurzbach, who we heard, envisions the communion table that extends to kitchen tables. I'm not making this up. You see why we like him. So that through all of our eating, we can somehow be a witness to what we've seen here on a Sunday morning. And I know that's easier said than done. I do. Because food is a holy and humbling mystery. And every time any sort of creature eats, any creature, including human beings, it participates in God's life-giving yet very costly ways that simultaneously affirm creation as just this beautiful, delectable gift, and as a divinely, like, ordered membership that we are graced to be part of. But it also affirms that things die in order for us to eat them. Always. When people sit down at a table to eat, we demonstrate with the unmistakable evidence of our stomachs that we are not self-subsisting gods. Just think about that for a minute. We have to feed this machine called our body. We're finite. We're mortal creatures, and we depend on God's many good gifts. So what are some of those good gifts? Sunlight, photosynthesis, decomposition, soil, we heard about, fertility, water, bees, butterflies, chickens, sheep, cows, gardeners, farmers, cooks, thank God for cooks, strangers, friends, and I'm just naming a few. I'm sure you're already naming your own list. Eating reminds us that we participate in a grace-saturated world, a blessed creation worthy of attention, hopefully care, and really, hopefully, great celebration. Next time you think or want to say to someone in your kitchen table or Matt and I don't know what grace is. Linda, I don't get grace. Here's a clue. Just think about the last meal you had. Just think about that. We say there's no such thing as cheap grace. Well, there's no such thing as cheap or convenient food either. Not really. Because real food, the food that is the source of health and delight, takes time. Takes time. So when we decide to believe other than that, that food is cheap or convenient, we do great harm. Our willingness to make our meals perfunctory and mindless does great harm. Ignoring the fact that we have choices even when we feel that we don't does great harm. And in order to turn away from that harm and to turn towards doing good, we have to first acknowledge that we do harm. Just name it. When we say all means all, it means God's love is for all of creation. And when we profess to follow God through the example of breaking bread during communion, we're saying that we will honor food and we'll honor eating and we'll honor where our food comes from and who plants it and who cares for it before it gets to us. We'll do our best to wonder about the wages that we pay those people, the conditions in which they live, the fertilizers and the pesticides that we insist that they buy and use so our fruit and vegetables look perfect instead of like they actually came off a tree. We insist they buy certain kind of seeds. And all of this insisting often forces them into buying things in an economic system that bends towards wealth for a few and oppression and lack of freedom for many. I want to show you something. This is my food box. This is a tomato. This is a napkin because I'm wearing white. Okay? So, it's a tomato. But it becomes something more than a tomato very soon. So I took it out of a box. That box is what comes every week from Soil Born Farms, which is a local farm in our area. And they deliver fruits and vegetables. And herbs, too. And before it got in that box, it was chosen. This tomato was chosen by a farmer to be worthy to go in the box, which means worthy means ripe enough. Ripe enough to eat, but not too ripe so it's going to spoil before you prepare your meal. That's a fine art. But that choosing was the end of a very long process, which began for the farm at the beginning of the season and sometimes before that when they chose, what are we going to grow? What do people need to eat? You see, a tomato is not just a tomato. Okay, I'm going to do this now.
Have to stay. You want this. I eat a lot with Sarah Marshall, so I'm going to pass it to her because she won't think I have cooties. And she likes to eat tomatoes like that, too.
It stays with you. The willingness to abuse or ignore where food comes from is a willingness not to take care of each other, to damage the earth. And if we damage the earth, we damage our own children. So I want to say it in a more positive way. To love the ground is to love that tomato. To love the fruit is to love the eaters of fruit. That's all of us. Our very lives and the lives of our children and everyone else's children depends on us loving this earth. We no longer live in a world of single threats to our food economy. We may well be on a course for a perfect storm of sequential or even simultaneous food-related calamities that fundamentally change our ability to live in food security. And I'm very aware I'm talking about this in the United States, where many places on this earth, it's already happened and is happening. And we don't want this, do we? I don't think we do. So here's the beautiful and hopeful thing. If Jesus Christ's life, in all its truth and fullness, is made known to us in the communion meal, and if it is central to us, then it is the place where we learn how we are fed. At communion, we receive the nurture and training we need to become people who participate in Jesus' healing and reconciling ways in the world. Eating Jesus is what I'm talking about. Eating Jesus is the ritual act we call communion that has the potential to transform for us our eating so that it can become hospitable and sacred. All of history demonstrates that communion, communing with each other, has and continues to be understood and practiced all over the planet in so many different ways. For some people, the table is the place where Jesus is met in the earthly elements of bread and wine. Others see the table as a memorial in which believers recall the saving act of Jesus. And they give thanks for that act. Others eat Jesus' broken body, and they talk about it that way. But the thing they have in common is the bread and the cup, the meal. And we don't need, really, to worry about all those details all of the time, because the ritualized character of communion can overcome all of that. You see, so many people think that in order to come and participate in this meal, you have to have deemed yourself worthy to God in some way. Is that what you think before you eat breakfast? You eat breakfast because you're hungry. And it's time to feed yourself to be productive for the day. We want people to be that free at this communion table. Not that you have everything figured out, but that you want to take your place at the table means that you want to taste new life. You want to get energy and life to go forward as a spiritually seeking person who wants to root their life in grace and grow in faith. Eating invites us to commune with other people, but it also invites us to discover and commune with God, who is the source and sustainer of all of our planet. So our hope is today and every day that this table and this meal that we're about to have might be for you life-giving here, but even more radically, it might, beginning today, shape all of the other meals that you have from this day forward.
If I could see Earth from outer space, through all of the stars to the human race, to all of the people and the streets that I once knew. If I could see Earth from outer space, through all of the stars to the human race, no matter where I go, I'll still come back to you. If I could fly, fly, soar, so high, higher than the clouds, even up in the sky, zoom, zooming in upon the world, rolling by, would I see people in the streets, in the villages and squares, selling in the marketplaces, dancing everywhere, would I see ladies in the beauty parlor doing hair, and teenage soldiers with their guns up in the air, would I see a hit list of the species that are gone, or would I be a witness to the world dropping bombs, I said, would I be rainforest, Amazon gone, or would the whole world sing one song? If I could see word from outer space, through all of the stars to the human race, to all of the people and the streets that I once knew. If I could see Earth from outer space, through all of the stars to the human race, no matter where I go, I still come back to you. You, you, no matter where I go, I still come back to you.